Welcome to the Molecular Ecologist Podcast, a conversation about ecology, evolution, and everything in between. Each episode, contributors to the Molecular Ecologist discuss the science we've been reading and writing about. I'm Jeremy Yoder. I'm the editor of the Molecular Ecologist and an assistant professor of biology at CSU Northridge in Los Angeles. Joining me today, we have...
Kelly Friel. I'm a postdoc with MicroPay at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology.
Hi, I'm Sean Abrams. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Missouri studying phylogenetics.
And I'm Katie Grogan. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati in anthropology and biology. That's the first time I've gotten to say that. So exciting. And I'm an anthropological geneticist.
Cool. So on this episode, we're doing something a little different. We are going to cover just one topic as a panel discussion, and that topic will be something that Sean came up with, actually, I think originally in the Molecular Ecologist Slack.
Maybe I just stressed about it, and then we decided to do a thing.
Yeah, but it's a pretty critical question in academic science, certainly, where one of the things we're constantly thinking about is scientific publications. And so how do we choose a scientific journal to publish our papers? Obviously the journal also chooses us through peer review, there's this process, but in the first place, how do we decide which journal to submit, what seems like a good prospect? So I'm gonna throw it out to the panel. What is your philosophy of choosing a journal to submit to?
So I'll go ahead and go first. I was thinking about this earlier and realized that your philosophy will change as you go through career stages. So In the discussion online, the focus is often on impact factor. That is generally what we are, as graduate students, we are informed. Impact factor is extremely important, etc. But I realized that as an early career researcher, particularly if you're planning to apply for fellowships or postdocs or faculty jobs, timeline and fit of the journal, and basically how quickly can you get it published in a reasonably good impact factor journal, has been my main motivating factor. So what I tend to do is go through the list of citations or the references of the paper, highlight and basically tally. How many times did I cite papers from each journal and then submit to the one that I cited the most from? Because that seems to be the journal that I'm most likely to get it published in, as like that it will be accepted in quickly, because the fit will be good. Only if it is something really, really exciting and fantastic do I do what I believe, and you guys may contradict me on this, is the more traditional route of starting at the highest impact factor I think I can get it in, and then sort of going down the list. Because for me, getting it published within the next 12 months has been more important. And often if you're sort of going down the ladder of impact factor, it can take a little longer.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that for the timeline, especially for everyone who's in maybe a short-term contract or something where you're trying to move on to something else relatively quickly, when some journals might take, I don't know what the longest you guys have all dealt with, but I would be kind of curious to hear. But I mean, I've heard people taking up to 6 months to hear back or even longer. So it's really, not an interesting venue if you think you're going to maybe have to be fixing things on the paper you submitted in the next 9 months or something like that, which is not a reasonable timeline. But I think one of the first things I think about is really how broad or specific my story is for the paper. So what kind of journal I'm looking for really might, the first kind of pass of sorting out which one to look at might be, really thinking about what I have to tell regarding my study. So if it's really more broad impact or interest, or if I need to go something a little bit more specific, it's probably one of the first brushstrokes that I go with.
Yeah, I get, so as a PhD student who is in that, like, okay, I need to try and get as many papers out as I can for so that I can seem like I did something with my 5 years or whatever. you're stuck in this place of definitely not knowing the landscape. I mean, yes, you can look up impact factors, but particularly for newer journals, and then that can be harder to do. And then do you go with a society journal versus one that isn't necessarily, or is a for-profit journal, for example, where for a society, you know, those are, like, I've been a member of the BSA, the Botanical Society of America, since I was in high school, randomly. And so I feel like I have commitment to that academic community. Should I not be trying to submit in there when I can, and when my research and there, they can be a pretty a broad set of topics, as long as they, you know, focus around plants, can go in there, versus something that might look better, quote unquote, in whether it's higher impact or that's a specific community that I'm trying to speak to with this paper. Yeah, those are the kind of questions I guess I think about.
Yeah, those are all the kinds of things that I think about myself. Katie, you are way more systematic about this than I am, but I definitely do. I have chosen journals as targets because I'm doing work that builds on something that I know was previously published in that journal, and I can kind of say, oh, I know this journal is interested in that topic, and they might be interested in the next chapter of that topic, right? And I also am motivated by sort of allegiances to journals and to societies. I think of one of my warm fuzzy journals is the American Naturalist, which I think I now have more papers there than anywhere else. But I'm also, I'm a member of ASN. I get to publish up to 12 pages without page fees as a result of that every year. That's a motivating factor. There's sort of multiple feedbacks there, right? I read the journal, I'm thinking about topics the journal is interested in, I'm doing science the journal is interested in.
Would you say, and this is for a question for all of you, would you say you ever pick a journal based off of who you think's going to be reviewing it? Like, oh, you know, these are, you know, because some, you know, I would say probably the majority of peer review journals, it's an anonymous review process, but I know there's some journals who have gotten where the reviewers identify themselves, or and I'm sure there are some cases where, you know, especially if you've had a really unfair or mean, overly critical review, you know, there was some things on Twitter where someone was basically live tweeting their tearing down of somebody's review process to feel good. You know, things like that happen, that you, okay, maybe I won't submit to this journal, or maybe I won't try this again because that was a really bad experience. Do you all have anything like that, or does that come into your mind when you're thinking about journal submission?
So yes, I just had a paper published in PNAS recently as a co-author, and part of our process was definitely looking at the editorial board to try to target who we thought would be a good person to handle the paper. Because like Kelly was saying, you know, broadness in particular, if the topic is really broad, you want to make sure there's someone, you want to be as targeted as possible in your submission process. And so that starts with identifying a potential handling editor, which some journals will let you suggest, to identifying potential reviewers. I've heard from many editors that you really ought to suggest potential reviewers, that they do use those lists, although I have heard a few problematic issues with that, where if you subject, you know, where sometimes editors will say, oh, those are definitely the people I'm not sending it to, but I believe that's pretty rare. And I have definitely, I'm with Jeremy on cost, checking out the cost, because our listeners may or may not know, if you go with an open access journal or some of the higher impact journals like Nature, I believe publishing in Nature costs something around $5,000 right now. Not open access necessarily, just the page print costs right there. An open access journal can often cost $3,500, so $3,500. And the question for me is always, do I have the funds available? Obviously, I try to be open access as much as possible, but the page costs really can add up. And then also, Sean, yeah, a good experience with a journal. There are a couple of journals that I will likely never submit to again because of negative experiences where, for example, one paper went through three rounds of external review and then got rejected after 15 months, I believe, in review. Issues like that. Whereas versus other journals, my particular favorite in ecology and in evolution, there's one where the editor heard the story of this paper that had been rejected three times, told me that was ridiculous and accepted it, asked to see all the reviews and accepted it as is after seeing the reviews. And so I will always be grateful, and that will be one of my favorite journals forever. So some of it is a little biased personal feelings as well. In addition to Jeremy, that was a bare, what I said before was the bare minimum of what I do to go through and pick a journal. There's a list. I've got a 10-step list of things that I do, which I'm happy to elaborate if you're interested.
I wouldn't be against seeing your 10-step list someday. That would be kind of fascinating. So, you know, and actually, like, when I was thinking about this discussion we were going to have, I think I was starting to think of how maybe over the last, I'm not sure, maybe 10 to 15 years, how people have changed maybe how you decide what journal you're looking at. And one of the things that came to mind is that we have this, like, you know, Google Scholar, which is like a pervasive thing that everyone uses, even though we maybe sometimes know it might not be the best way to do it. And there's many other good search engines. But I was trying to Google something along the lines of like impact factor and Google Scholar, like maybe there's been a study on how that, how those two interplay or how what has happened. And the very first question that came up as a suggested question was, why is Google Scholar bad? Which I thought was really funny. And then of course I had to click on that. And then, you know, many, many rabbit holes later, but really a lot of ideas talk.
Wait,
about,
why is Google Scholar bad? Wait.
So I went on many clicking adventures here. And one of them led me to a blog post that I'm going to try to find right now. But essentially, it was a PLOS One blog covered by, I'm going to find the author momentarily. But she talked about a recent presentation that she had seen, basically tweets, people tweeting about a recent presentation that was out. And it was a 2019 presentation that she saw tweets about. Anyway, that was basically a study saying that the number of citations has narrowed on the number of, it's, instead of being kind of broad across multiple journals and kind of broadly distributed, they've sort of narrowed down. And the author linked this to the use of Google Scholar, which essentially is shoving you towards maybe the most cited things or maybe the top hits in a certain keyword search. So the bad part was that you're maybe not really throwing your net as broadly as you should be necessarily. And some papers that could be quite relevant that perhaps you would come across if you use maybe a web of knowledge search, or I'm not sure, another thing that's more targeted for your specific topic or the authors you're looking for, perhaps would be a little bit ignored. So I thought that was pretty interesting to say the least.
That really highlights the way that, you know, the algorithm, in quotation marks, or the way the search algorithms work and how they put things in front of us really shape our experiences with online resources and ways we might not be interacting.
Totally. I've thought about it, but I haven't thought about it that in depth. And I just found the blog post that I had read was called Google Scholar Risks and Alternatives by Hilda Bastian. And the paper that, or the presentation she was citing from tweets was from a meta science symposium in 2019, and the author looks like was Jevin West. So these aren't people that I'm particularly familiar with, and they're not in my topic, I don't think. But I just wanted to throw that out there because I wanted to cite what I was reading.
Yeah, we'll have to link to that in the show notes. So to maybe back up just a little bit, we've had multiple people talk about impact factor as a consideration in all of this, and both in how we navigate the literature in general, but also how we decide what journals are good choices. So impact factor, right, is an estimate of the average number of citations that papers in a journal, or that each paper in a journal receives over some set period of time. I think they're compiled by a couple of different sources, but the closest ones that are canonical are through Web of Knowledge, if I'm remembering correctly. And Kelly, you did some digging on the origins of this practice and this statistic,
yes.
Right?
So I guess since impact factor is a thing that keeps coming up, as I was trying to read on what other people use to decide what journals they pick, impact factor inevitably will be somewhere in the discussion. Either it will be something people support and say is helpful, or something that people are very angry about and dislike, which seems to be the two opinions on many, many blogs. But I was interested in trying to understand a little bit better, and surprised that I really didn't know when impact factor became a thing or where it came from. So I did a little bit of digging. I am clearly no expert on this topic still. However, in 1975, Eugene Garfield and the Institute of Scientific Information, which is what he founded, which was really more of a business than an academic institution, so it sounds a little bit more academic-y, but just to note that. So he wanted to add a new thing to what he was doing, and it was called the Journal Citations Report. And although he had kind of kicked around this idea, previously, the idea of sort of an impact factor had been around since maybe 1963. It was 1975 when it first was sort of published as now this is a thing. And Eugene Garfield, I had to do a little bit of reading about him because I was curious, but it sounds really from a variety of sort of some different opinion pieces on his life. So he passed away in 2017. So there was a smattering of publications that came out kind of talking about his contribution to science in a variety of ways. But one of them, and the main one that people are maybe familiar with, is this impact factor. So he was all about trying to get information to scientists to try to better inform decisions in a way. So he called himself an information engineer. So he was really about trying to organize stuff and get information out in sort of a fashion that would be discernible, or kind of a way that you could sort through it and get the most out of it in a short period of time. In addition to the impact factor, the Journal Citations Report, he also published another pamphlet, or maybe a booklet, that was called Current Content. And it was essentially photos all compiled of a bunch of top articles that were out in whatever last period of time. I'm not sure what the period of time was, but he covered, to begin with, maybe 150 different journals, and it would basically be something you'd get in the mail. And it was in the time where, you know, we can't Google things and you have to either have a subscription or, you know, maybe go to the library to sort something out or to get some information on a paper. So from what I could tell, a lot of people actually had this little pamphlet delivered to them so that they could try to sort what was a key thing to read. But if we go back to the impact factor thing, his whole idea was really to try to help authors decide where to publish. And part of this was a journal-to-journal citation index, where he tried to get, so for example, if you're a biologist, but you do some mathy things, this was from one of the blogs I read, so I didn't make this analogy up, but if you did some mathy things, and you wanted maybe biologists and mathematicians to have access to your study, it was a guide to be like, okay, this article, this journal gets not only cited by biologists, but also mathematician. So that might be a good way for you to find your audience there. So I thought it was, you know, when he first published this, he also threw out that there's a bunch of caveats so that it shouldn't be the only metric that is used to decide things. And I think even at the time, there were criticisms about how this number would inadvertently impact people, perhaps not in ways that he was foreseeing quite yet. But at the onset, it was really a way to try to help people sort through papers that are out there and direct you not only to maybe things that you're interested in, but where to publish your research. So yeah, a lot of other things came out of that, and many, many people have very intense opinions one way or
another. Well, you saying that and the analogy of the, you know, math and science person really makes me think about, you know, integrated research and how research is getting more and more integrative. And when you were describing it, I was like, oh my gosh, I would love a system like that. But I don't really think that impact factor necessarily does. Like, if someone could tell me, you know, oh, this is the journal that you should publish in if you're interested in genomics and metabolism and phylogeny, and that those three people are going to be, you know, reading in this area, I'd be like, oh, haha, oh, great, I would love that guide. But I don't know how I would pull that out of impact factor necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very valid way to think about it. And actually, I thought, so I also, I mean, everyone probably glances at Wikipedia whenever they're looking stuff up. So from the Wikipedia page about impact factor and this gentleman, at the very bottom, there's like a really tiny paragraph about criticism. And all it does is throw out like two really, one way or the other, like really harsh or really positive sentences people have said. And I want to give you this criticism of impact factor that was written in 2007 by David, oh man, his last name, Colohuen of University College London. And he described the impact factor as the invention of Eugene Garfield, a man who has done enormous harm to true science. So I feel like, so, you know, I don't think you're alone in kind of wondering the utility of it, but also it makes me think about, you know, would there, if he hadn't come up with impact factor, what would have been enough? I'm sure that there would have, people would probably want to try to understand some sort of grading. Like all of us want to organize things as scientists. I mean, that's why we have like phylogenetic trees, because we're trying to understand the relationship of things to each other. So I'm very curious if this impact factor didn't exist, like what other creative or different ways might have evolved to try to understand, I don't know, not importance, I don't know if that's the right word, but like try to guide you towards different articles that are most relevant, or journals perhaps is better.
Yeah, and I don't want to out myself as a socialist necessarily, but but there's also like a capitalist lean that, because we can't, like we were just saying earlier, you do have to pay to be in these journals. And if you have a higher impact journal, you can charge people more money to have to publish in that journal. And that is a way in mm-hmm. which they make money. And if there was a different system for how we judge journals, maybe that wouldn't be such a major aspect of the publishing process, you know, something that, you know, is tied to the, not only the like work that we're doing, but to the way that, you know, scientists put food on their table, right? Yeah.
You know, Sean, there is sort of a service that does what you're asking, which is called Jane. It's the Journal Author Name Estimator. It's not great. It's usable, but it's not great. We'll put this in the show notes, but basically you post your abstract of your paper in there, and what it's supposed to do is mine abstracts of journals and recently published papers and give you basically a suggested list of here's where your paper will fit best. I found that if I put in an already published paper, it's pretty good at identifying the journal it's in, but it's not always great at identifying maybe when I'm trying to find a place, but I have used it frequently to maybe once a paper's been rejected once or twice, and now there's like a list of three or four journals it could possibly go to, because we haven't talked about this yet, but like there's often The first journal, it may be very clear where it's going to go. And the second journal may be very clear if it gets rejected. But by the time you get to three, four, you know, once you get through a couple of rejections, it may be less clear. And so I have used Jane before to make sure that I'm on the right track and to maybe get some new ideas for journals that I wouldn't have thought of, like you were talking about, Sean, with like, oh, mathematicians might want to see this, et cetera. Like I said, it's usable, but not... it's one of the lower down steps that I use in my 10-step process.
Well, that, and I wonder, like, have you ever looked, does it list, and I know I've glimpsed it before, but does it list the impact factors of those journals as well? Because that's, because then it says, oh, your abstract sounds like you should be in a higher impact journal versus in a lower impact. And I'm wondering how problematic that might be as well. But maybe we need to just stop thinking about impact factor when we're considering these types of things, and maybe that's just part of the discussion as well.
I will answer that question in 1 second because I'm gonna only put an abstract in. You guys continue your discussion.
I think it's really interesting you bring up just kind of the thing people have suggested, it seems like, to disregard impact factor. What's really funny and what, I mean, I've seen in multiple kind of posts that are trying to give advice about impact factor, they might negate how, you know, it's maybe not the best way to do it, but for early career researchers and selection committees, it's almost, you know, annoyingly essential thing that you strive for, because I'm sure that perhaps you guys have also heard this as advice or been on a search committee and witnessed this happening, but I've had multiple interactions, multiple professors that have also suggested, you know, it's not, you know, the main thing you should have a million high impact journals, but it is good to have one in there that kind of helps that search committee perhaps. And Kathleen, you were recently hired, so I don't know if you think that impacted your when you were searching for jobs, or how do you feel about that if you interacted with search committees or interviews? Was that a question that came up?
So to answer Sean's question earlier, Jane does not tell you impact factor. It does, however, tell you article influence number from eigenfactor.org, which is basically it measures how often articles are cited within the first 5 years after publication. And it's weighted based on the influence of the journal that the citations come from. So it does include a list of not an equivalent of impact factor, but something sort of similar. But that doesn't seem to factor into what suggestions Jane gives you for what to publish. And I'm sorry, Kelly, I missed your question while I was digging into this. Did you ask, me about search committees and whether they asked me about the impact factor of my papers?
Or if you just felt like it was, you know, while you were searching for jobs or in any of your job process, kind of did you feel like that was something that was considered by the committee? I don't imagine it was like a direct conversation because they just see your CV and they know it. But I just wonder what your experience is with that, or any past comments that you've gotten from mentors or anything regarding the necessity.
When I was on interviews, no one asked me. To be clear, up until this paper in PNAS, I had nothing in a journal above like a 4, I think. That was peer reviewed. And so I don't, but I have sat as a graduate representative on search committees before and have heard the sort of normally expected commentary about, oh, this person has a Cell, Nature, or Science paper. Other than that, impact factor doesn't seem to come up in my experience, other than sort of to say their papers are published in the good field journals or not. It seemed more about the quality of the work and the quantity than the impact factor of the journal. I think because everybody's kind of aware that impact factor, while we use it as a metric, is not great for some of the reasons you elaborated on, but also for lots of other reasons. And impact factor it's influenced by decisions made about papers in terms of how much space the journal has, in terms of if you get one bad review, et cetera. There's a lot of different things that go into why your paper may not be in sort of a higher impact journal, et cetera. That doesn't seem, not in my experience.
And I imagine on some level for the higher impact journals, there's also, intentional or not, there's a level of gatekeeping that can go in there where, oh yes, or maybe PNAS, you know, there was the recent controversy where there was a paper that maybe did not get the best peer review, because I think a part of being a part of the National Academy is you get a shorter publishing time. But you know, where you get to move quicker through that, and then it wasn't quite as scientifically sound of a paper, but you're a National Academy member, or, you know, if you have a big name in the field, or if you have the right person on the paper, you know, how many big scientific or science adjacent academic papers scandals have resulted because some person just added somebody's name on their paper to get through the, so that people could check off on it, and then turns out, oh, the data's fake, or, oh, you know, XYZ. So,
yeah, there has been, I think there has been shown an effect where you are, as a junior author, more likely to get into one of the big high impact journals if you have a co-author who has previously published there. I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if that actually applies way down the impact ladder too, because there's an effect of, you know, having someone as a co-author who knows the editorial process and the interests of the journal. But that becomes more problematic at these high visibility journals, right? And it occurs to me, there's an interesting sort of dual purpose for impact factors from the perspective of the author and of someone who's looking at the CV of like a prospective faculty hire, right? Which is that, if you're using impact factor to evaluate someone's publications list, you're kind of hoping that it predicts the future citations and scientific impact of these papers that maybe just came out last year, and you don't know how they're going to play out over time. But if you're an author, you're more interested in the size of the audience that the paper is getting, which definitely contributes to its possibility of citation. And I think that's a little less of an issue than it used to be, but there it's still absolutely true that papers published in Nature and Science and Cell and PNAS get more attention outside the scientific community and inside the scientific community than papers published in like the American Naturalist or the American Journal of Botany.
There was an interesting study recently that looked at citations and audience, basically, that showed, this is more related to Twitter, that if you promote the paper on Twitter, that paper, those papers are much more likely to be cited in the future. And so that is a way of not circumventing, but assisting a paper that might be in a sort of a lower audience or a smaller audience area. I did want to mention really quickly, as we're on this sort of, it's a sidebar from impact factor, but other things that I think about when I'm deciding a journal, like I mentioned, early career, so publication delays. There was an analysis back in 2015 that scraped all of these papers looking at how long it took from submission to decision, from decision to publication. That analysis is a little out of date, but I definitely go through the last few issues to look at how long papers are generally taking, because like I said, I don't have time for my paper to sit in review for 150 days. That is a long time. And I just don't have time for that. The other thing we were talking before we started this about bioarchive, and most journals now accept papers published on bioarchive, but that wasn't always the case. So like 4 or 5 years ago, a lot of journals were not accepting papers that had been posted on BioArchive, because the paper then becomes the property of the journal. It's a copyright issue. And so that's another thing I always just have, you want to do a really quick check to all of our listeners. Always make sure if you're going to post something on BioArchive, or you're thinking about where journal, what to submit to, make sure that the journal will accept it, that it's okay with them.
Yeah, preprint servers are a great potential solution for that kind of issue of the time that it takes to get a paper fully published, right? Because it creates a public versioned thing that you can point to say, this is a real paper, it's gonna get published somewhere. I've done this work. But it does, you still have that issue with eventual journal publication. This is maybe as good a time as any to say, Katie, why don't you just tell us your whole 10 steps?
Okay, so this is embarrassing. So I start with, like I said, the list of references and tally how many times I cite papers from specific journals. Then I take a look at the top five and look at publication delays, publication costs, sort of fit an audience of the journal. How broad is it? How narrow? Do we have anything previously in the journal that we have submitted that's part of the story? You don't think that's necessarily important, but I've actually used that as an argument to ask that a rejection be overturned, arguing that this is part of a story that this journal has published previously, and so you can't. So the decision that this isn't a good fit is inaccurate, and it helped. It actually overturned the rejection, and that paper was ultimately published in that journal because it was part of a story that we had been publishing. Like I said, then I take a look at what funds I have available. I take a look at the editorial board to see if there are people on there that will be are familiar with my work. I take a look at my personal experience with the journal. Have I published there before? Was it positive? Was it negative, et cetera? I actually ask friends if they've had bad experiences with that journal. Just to, not necessarily, you know, terrible, but just did it take a long time? Were the reviewers, you know, did they have a good time, an easy time finding reviewers, et cetera? I check out Jane. I make sure that that I can put a paper on BioArchive because I almost always do that. So I make sure that it fits there, or that the journal doesn't have an embargo on that kind of thing. I look at whether they sponsor the data being submitted to Dryad, the open access data repository, and if they do, because that's about, I think it's $120 to put your data up on Dryad, and some journals will pay that for you, some won't. I think that's it. I don't have it written down, but that seems like my big long list of things that I go through and check.
That's a good list.
Great list.
Yeah, I think
write it out. Maybe I'll write it out and add it to Sean's blog about all of this, about here are the steps that I take.
Yeah, it would be something to see the flowchart.
I think I like a few of your points in particular. So I think down many rabbit holes and finding what other people have said about journal picking, because I was kind of curious. And not only are there like a huge smattering of blogs that are about this, but Twitter is like, you know, rife with people asking for how to decide what a journal article or journal to submit to, and you know, a plethora of responses to all of those tweets. And I mean, their tweet, these are, you know, this is a question that has been asked for many, many years. But one of the things that came up was definitely on point with what you just said, which was having poor experiences with a journal previously and not wanting to submit. So I won't name the journal, but somebody said that essentially they didn't get any author proof before the article was published, and that table one was duplicated. So that I'm sure looked great whenever that was up online. And then for the correction, the journal just decided to put a footnote in without asking the authors for any commentary on what the correction might say. So it sounded like a bad enough experience that this person was essentially like, I will never submit here again, and I will tell everyone not to submit here. So I think it is really good to touch base with colleagues and friends, and, you know, reach out and try to see at some point, you know, if it's a really bad experience, then why continue to propagate articles in that journal and to help that journal keep going. So I can understand that.
Mine's a more selfish region. I just don't want to deal with the negative experience. I don't want my paper to sit in review for months and months. I don't want to deal with three revise and resubmits and then a rejection. I don't want to deal with an editor who won't handle reviewer comments that might be maybe sexist or racist or any really bad reviewer behavior, which is really actually quite rare, despite what Twitter says. It's quite rare, but you know, that my understanding is that's an editor's job to address. And so if I know people who have had particularly bad experiences, mine's a totally selfish reason, Kel. I don't want to deal with it. Getting rejected is hard enough. I don't need to deal with all the extra pieces.
That's totally fair. Just because you just mentioned dealing with bad reviewers, I want to throw out this article that was published in PeerJ, I think at the end of last year, that is entitled Unprofessional Peer Reviews Disproportionately Harm Underrepresented Groups in STEM. And maybe we can link to that one as well. It's a pretty interesting article. And it was
From a colleague of mine at CSUN.
Oh, she was Nissa is from the Tobo lab here at HIMB previously. So we had discussions regarding it, partly because of that connection. But it's a good article to read anyway.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily get to the frequency of those issues, but it does certainly establish that they happen and they're a thing to think about.
Agreed.
We are coming up on maybe the end, but I wanted to also get in that the molecular ecologist has a bit of a connection to one of the more ambitious attempts to deal with this overarching issue. Our founding blog editor, Tim Vines, who was more importantly the former managing editor of the journal Molecular Ecology, started a service called Axios Review, it was an independent peer review service that operated separately from journals. And the idea was that you submitted a paper to Axios and suggested reviewers, and you listed the journals where you thought you might send the paper. And one of the things that the reviewers were asked to do, in addition to evaluating the paper on its scientific merits, was to give their feedback on that list of journals and say, oh, I think it would be best here, or sort of rank them as appropriate. And then the idea was that Axios would be able to refer the paper to that top choice journal that you and the reviewers had agreed on with the reviews, and say to the journal editor, look, this has already been through a round of review. These folks all agree that this is a good fit. You can sort of push this ahead in the process and maybe save a round of evaluation. And that actually was, they had the whole process operating, and they had agreements in place with a bunch of journals in ecology and evolutionary biology, because that was Tim's initial network. But the challenge was sort of getting authors on board.
I have a quick corrections corner. I wasn't around when Nissa was at Toba, or was in at HIMB, and she was actually in the Donahue lab. That was my edit. Want to throw that out there.
Roger.
I want to add a piece. Speaking of what sort of on Jeremy's comment about Axios Review, part of my list of things that I do, ask your co-authors. They often have really good suggestions or things you haven't thought of. That's another thing. You send them a list. Here's our tiered list of journals we're going to submit to. Do you have any comments? That's like the last step in my process. Yeah, Jeremy, I don't. That's an odd one. The issue with that for me as an early career is that I get worried about signing my reviews, to be honest. And something like that, it's a public domain where I am required to attach my name to something. Yeah.
Oh, so I think Axios allowed reviewers to remain anonymous to the authors.
Well, in that case.
Yeah, the part of the tricky part of setting it all up was getting sort of a channel established where the paper and the reviews could all be shunted to a target journal. I think the challenge was that the business model was kind of tricky. So basically, authors had to pay for the review service, and the value of that was supposed to be that you were saving yourself the process of bouncing around possible journals and maybe even a round or two of peer review at the journal that you eventually publish at. So it was supposed to speed the process along. And actually Tim had some data to the effect that demonstrated that from the back end. But it was challenging, I think, to get authors to really internalize that savings, and it felt like you were being asked to pay for something extra when you could just choose your own journal.
Well, and I think that would be something I'd be interested in doing once it had been like proven, like once I'd seen a lot of people doing it. It seems like BioArchive was a little bit like that, where it took a critical mass of people to start posting and really see the effects of having posted something publicly, that there weren't negative consequences necessarily, and there were a lot of pluses. It sounds like a great service, but it's something that I would be hesitant as a lowly student or postdoc without funds to have to pay for my reviews, even if it sounds like a great idea in terms of speed.
Yeah, it was a couple $100, I think, or less than $200. You got a pretty steep discount if you reviewed for them. So like there was a bit of a reviewer marketplace thing layered into it. And actually, the long-term goal for the project was that journals would pay eventually. If they could get enough authors using it, journals would say, oh, this is a way to get papers that we know are appropriate to us. They save us a round of review. We can give them some money to put that in place, to make that like a standard submission approach for us. But they didn't get to that point.
Was a part of the model that they would be like high-quality reviews as well?
Yeah, they were reviewed to the same standards that Molecular Ecology or Evolution or AMNAT or any of the journals that they were working with were doing, because they were drawing from for EEB, they were drawing from basically the same pool of folks who were acting as associate editors and reviewers of all those journals.
Well, I asked that because, you know, I limited experience, but with some of their reviews, sometimes you get a reviewer that is 3 sentences and then someone who really goes in and, you know, gives you detailed feedback and makes your paper better versus someone who's just skimming through to make sure that they got their review for the done in that time. So if on the point of like, oh, are we paying for this extra thing, if it's really good reviews, maybe that's not so bad.
Yeah, I don't know what it would. I think it's down to the critical adoption mass, and I don't know if anybody's figured out a way to make that sales pitch that would make it possible. Anyway, we should probably wrap it up. I have a meeting in about a minute. but thanks everybody. This has been a great conversation. Sean, do you feel like you have any better idea of how you're gonna shop around your first paper?
Yeah, I think so. I got a long list. You know, let me write up a summary of our conversation and then I'll commit it to memory as a part of the process.
you can listen to the podcast on loop.
Yeah, I appreciate everybody's thoughts and tips. I'll have to add my list of how I decide just went from 10 steps to 15, it sounds like.
Okay, great. Yes. You'll be able to find links to that and to everything else that we've discussed on this episode on themolecularecologist.com on the show page. And you can follow updates from The Molecular Ecologist on Twitter at MOL Ecologist, or find us on Facebook by searching for Molecular Ecologist.
The Molecular Ecologist podcast is produced by turning on Zoom and hoping for the best. We're hosted on anchor.fm, and you can subscribe there or via Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and a bunch of other services. If you've enjoyed this episode, please take the time to rate and review it and help us build an audience. Thanks to our panelists Kelly Friel, Katie Grogan, and Sean Abrams. I'm Jeremy Yoder. Until next time, hoping all your code is bug-free, all your PCR targets amplify, and all your reviewers are friendly and thorough.